Well, I have sort of made a determination that I don't want us to get bogged down here in Proverbs, because there is just so much, and a lot of it is doesn't lend itself to going chapter by chapter, verse by verse, that kind of thing. And I would like to wrap things up by the time we sort of hit the end of the year, and maybe take a look at the book of James starting next year on Wednesday night, since it is the equivalent, it's sort of the wisdom literature of the New Testament. And in that light, rather than continuing on with all the different topics, we could go on for weeks and weeks and weeks. I would like for us to take a look at the last two chapters, tonight, chapter 30. And these are somewhat puzzling in the sense of the origins of them. One is attributed to Agur. The other is attributed to King Lemuel, neither of which we have a clue who these guys are. Some theories are that these are pseudonyms for Solomon, but I don't think that makes a lot of sense why Solomon would have put somebody else's name here. Then there's all sorts of speculation that, well, maybe King Lemuel is another king in the Middle East that Solomon was. What is interesting is that it would appear then that at least King Lemuel is not a Hebrew. And it would be one of the few places that we find scripture in the Old Testament coming from a non-Israelite. That's not completely foreign, as part of Daniel, you remember the words of Nebuchadnezzar. So that's not a completely way out thought, but it is certainly unusual, to say the least. You know, the last chapter is the chapter about the virtuous woman, the noble wife, sometimes she is called, and we'll take a look at that next time. Tonight is Agur. I would like for us to sort of look at the first six verses or so of this, and we're not going to, we'll sort of jump, skip verses every now and then as we work our way through this. I like Agur because he seems to be intrigued by numbers, and we'll see what I mean by that as we go. So let's just read this first six verses to get us started tonight. The words of Agur, the son of Jacob, and we don't know. One suggested the word Jacob, or the name Jacob, actually literally means the vomiter, the son of the vomiter. That would be a nice name, but nobody knows for certain. And the man spake unto Ithiel, even to Ithiel and Ukal. Again, we don't have a clue who these people are. Ithiel, at least, is a name that does appear in the Old Testament. It is a Hebrew name. El, as you remember, is one of the names for God. So typically when you see El in a name like Daniel or Joel, those types of names, you've got the name of Elohim, El, worked into it. So Ithiel at least is a Hebrew name, but these others, we don't have a clue. But anyway, this guy says some pretty interesting things. He says, surely I am more brutish than any man and have not the understanding of a man. I neither learned wisdom nor have the knowledge of the holy. Who hath ascended up into heaven or descended? Who hath gathered the wind in his fist? Who hath bound the waters in a garment? Who hath established all the ends of the earth? What is his name, and what is his son's name, if thou canst tell? Every word of God is pure. He is a shield unto them that put their trust in him. And add thou not unto his words, lest he reprove thee, and thou be found a liar. Well, let's just stop there for a second. Any observation? I want you to, y'all feel free to jump in here. Any observations about this? If you read those words, what seems to be the topic under discussion? What's the general theme? Sounds like Job, doesn't it? Who can do this? Who can, that song we sing, Behold Our God, has some of those same lines, which is coming, of course, from the book of Job. And of course, the idea is none but God can do such things. Those are rhetorical questions that we're supposed to know the answer to. What is that first part where he talks about, I'm more brutish than any man. I'm like to be brutish, to be a brute is to be beast-like. And says, I'm more brutish than a man. I have no understanding. Can y'all back that up? Put it in reverse. Next one. Back up. I'm sorry. Right there. Whoa. Yeah. He says, I have neither learned wisdom nor have knowledge of the holy. In other words, he is confessing his utter ignorance of who God is, how to get to God. And notice that line, who hath ascended up into heaven or descended? Does that ring a bell with anybody? Barry, you're nodding your head. I didn't know if you were nodding off or just... Okay, John chapter 3. Turn there just a second and take a look at that. In John 3, let's start with verse 12. This is in Jesus' conversation with Nicodemus by night, remember? And he says, if I have told you earthly things and you believe not, how shall you believe if I tell you heavenly things? And no man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man who is in heaven. We have these, what were they called? The word was on my lips there for a moment. Assumption stories that were circulating about the time of Christ of, men, notable men who were caught up to heaven to hear these mysteries and then come back down and share them with men on earth. The famous one, the one that was most prevalent, was called the Assumption of Moses. And these are apocryphal writings. They're just fiction. They're not scripture. But they are very common types of literature. The idea is that how do we know how to please our God? How do we know how to get to God? Because we cannot ascend to heaven. There's no one who has ascended to learn these secrets and then descended. But notice Jesus is basically saying the only one basically who can tell you these things is me, because I'm the one who has descended from heaven. And that language is very prevalent in John in the sense that he is the one who has come down from heaven. I'm thinking about preaching the Sunday right after Christmas. Sort of have a Christmas message along those lines. I've stumbled on one of Martin Luther's Christmas sermons that he's speaking along these lines. I thought it'd be very interesting to sort of follow his train of thought. But it's this whole notion of how do you know what you know about God? Basically, you are utterly dependent on his revelation. And that's what these verses go on to say. If y'all can move it forward now. In the sense, verse 5, every word of God is pure. He's a shield unto them who put their trust in him. In the next verse, don't you add to his words, lest he reprove you. Notice that the emphasis here is on the revelation that God gives to us from heaven, that we are incapable of reaching up to heaven and grasping the things of God. Even the Greeks, Aristotle, Socrates, Plato, were able to grasp certain things about God. And Paul tells us that's possible, that the hidden things of God are knowable from creation. Even they could reason that God cannot possibly be known by man. They called him the agnoston, the unknowable. That the only way you can possibly grasp and know God is as he reveals himself. And that is certainly true. That's what this passage is basically reminding us. That's what Christ is saying. But Christ is going on to say, I'm the one who is the full and complete revelation of God. He that has seen me has seen the Father. I'm the visible image of the invisible God. I am that revelation from heaven. Is this making sense? Do you understand what you said? Man cannot possibly climb his way up to God. He knows there's a God. He can reason certain things about God, but how to truly know Him in a pleasing way, how to be reconciled to God, how to come to God. He's absolutely lost. He can go out in a fishing boat, sit in the lake, and realize there's a God. But he can't go any further than that. Make sense? God's got to show him. God's got to come down from heaven in order for him to know those types of things. Okay, well, I get off the soapbox here. But, I mean, I like this guy. Hey, I don't know who he is, but I like this dude. He's has a grasp of truth. Yeah, David? Yeah, isn't that interesting? Tell me what his name is and what his son's name is. And it's almost a sense of, well, we know that, don't we? His name is Yahweh. His son's name is Jesus. We happen to know the name of the God, and we know the name of his son. Yeah, isn't that a strange way of putting it? So, okay, let's scoot on. Two things, and this is the first time we run into the number deal in this chapter. He says, two things have I required of thee. Deny me them not before I die. Remove far from me vanity and lies, and give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with food convenient for me, lest I be full and deny thee, and say, who is the Lord? Or lest I be poor and steal and take the name of my God in vain. What he's saying is basically there are two requests I have of thee, God, and I'm asking you not to deny me these two requests. The first one is make me, it's just two things. Don't make me too rich and don't make me too poor. How many of you pray to God, don't make me too rich? I didn't think so. That is the one that is the most deadly one because that's the one we fear the least. Now, I know you couldn't handle big money. I know that. But, of course, I could. I could. Yeah, it wouldn't ruin me. But it'd ruin you. I know that. And so that's the idea. The guy, whoever Agar is, realizes, no, I can't be trusted with big money. And I couldn't either. Very few are capable of being in the billionaire club and being godly men. It's very difficult. We think it would be different for us, but no, it would ruin us. And that's what Agur is saying. Don't let me be too rich, lest I deny you and take the name of, what is it, and say, who is the Lord? Now, what does he mean by that? Okay, I don't need God. That's the problem with too much stuff, too many riches. I don't need God anymore. But then he says, on the other hand, don't let me be too poor either, lest I steal and take the name of my God in vain. Now, that's a strange association, lest I steal. In other words, notice that Agur is not saying that poverty then gives you a license to steal. The problem is poverty brings the temptation to steal, and stealing's wrong. And so being poor tends to make me want to go steal your TV set, break into your house, take your stuff. But notice the association. It is, in his words, to take the name of my God in vain. What does that imply? Normally we associate taking the name, God's name in vain with what? Cussing, anger, yeah, cursing. But notice here he's associating it with stealing. The implication in my mind is that this is describing a religious man who puts on a religious front as being a worshiper of God, and yet secretly he steals. And so he is taking on the name of God in vain. He's a hypocrite. He's pretending to be something that he's not. All right? So that's the first one. Have y'all run into these are favorite passages of mine. Don't let me be too rich. Don't let me be too poor. So, hey, we seem to be getting, I don't see anybody in here real rich or anybody in here real poor. Everybody seems to be well fed, got clothes on your back, got a place to go home, nice warm place tonight. So, hey, you ought to be thankful. All right, let's go to the next one. You'll notice, and if you're reading another version, it won't read quite like this, but the words "there is," notice that every one of these verses begins with the words "there is," verse 11 down through verse 14, and that all of those are bracketed, which shows us that there is no manuscript authority for those words. Those words have been inserted by the translators trying to make the meaning more clear. If you're reading from an ESV or NIV, they leave the "there is" out, and they say "there are those" or something like that. I can't recall how they translate it. But in each case, all four verses begin with the same phrase in each translation that I've checked. And the King James is as good as any here. It says, "There is a generation that curses their father, does not bless their mother. There's a generation that are pure in their own eyes and yet is not washed from their filthiness. There is a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. There is a generation whose teeth are as swords and their jaw teeth as knives to devour the poor from off the earth and the needy from among men." All right. Give me summation of what is that about? What's the general theme that we're talking about here in those verses? Now notice we got four of them. And four becomes the important number for here on out. When it talks about in verse 13, "Oh, how lofty are their eyes, their eyelids are lifted up," what are we talking about? Pride. Pride, arrogance. And so that, in my mind, is the theme of this whole section. Number one, the arrogance or the haughtiness, the hubris. Are you all familiar with that term? Hubris. The fact of so full of yourself, you make these stupid statements. And notice the first one, the generation that curses their father and does not bless their mother. What is the connection between that and pride? Okay, well, that's what you're saying. But my question, I guess my question is, why is that so terrible? I mean, who's not to say that a child shouldn't be running the family? God. It is God who establishes the order, honor thy father and thy mother. E.W. Johnson used to point out that that is the one of the Ten Commandments that establishes that one section of society is to have authority over another section of society. And of the Ten Commandments, that's the only one that does that. And what he was then go on to say is that every other case in society of one group having authority over another group stems back to that commandment. That commandment says that it's okay for one group to have to honor another group. Y'all probably don't feel the force of that, but what he's saying is every other kind of authority in relationship to authority flows out of that one. So if a child does not honor their father and mother, he's probably not going to honor the policeman either. Probably not going to honor the school teacher either. You get the picture? David, was you? Okay, took the words right out of David's mouth. Yeah, that's the principle. So here the idea is, not only is it unlawful, but isn't it somewhat unnatural for the child not to reverence their father and their mother? If we just look at nature, does the child produce himself, give birth to himself, nurture himself? You get the picture that nature itself teaches you a primacy of the parent over the child. That there is a debt, if nothing else, there's a debt that the child owes the parent. Number one, for it being here in the first place, and number two, taking care of it when it can't take care of itself. Okay, so what I'm saying is, if you think of in terms of pride, you see it in that first verse, then notice they're pure in their own eyes even while they're not washed from their filthiness. They think they're better than they really are. That's the proud man. Then their look is lofty. It's that high look that God says he hates. It's the old saying, if it rained, they'd drown. They got their nose stuck so far up in the air. And then the last one is the interesting for me. There's a generation whose teeth are like swords and their jaw teeth like knives, and they're devouring the poor. Do you remember the story Jesus told of the publican and the Pharisee that went in the temple to pray? And the preface to that, he spoke this parable unto certain who trusted in themselves and despised others. That the problem with the haughty, with the proud, is not only do they think they're better than everybody else, they look at everybody else as prey for them. They're there for their exploitation. And that last verse is depicting that. So those two things go hand in hand. The man who is proud, lifted up in his own eyes, is a man who looks down on everybody else. So anyway, I just thought that was interesting that there you have this sort of four-verse set, all starting with the same words and all related by the same theme. David, you? A lot of things happened in the 60s. And I was there, and most of us didn't really realize the revolution that took place in thinking. And it has taken a long time for the revolution of thought that occurred in the 60s to hit the street, to sort of come home to roost. But it's certainly come home to roost now. It becomes apparent to me as someone who was there in the 60s and saw the counterculture, that the counterculture is now the culture. And the culture in the 60s is now the counterculture. In other words, what we are now is the counterculture. Right? You think about it. We don't fit in with the thinking of our culture. It is flip-flop. Okay. Yeah, having lived through it, I think you're exactly right, David. Daryl. Well, I think they describe what came out of the 60s, let's put it that way, and what is now the prevalent way of thinking. It is interesting the adulation of youth that, y'all remember the study we did way back there when I first came here on All God's Children in Blue Suede Shoes, one of the most interesting little studies I think we've done. And this guy, Ken Myers, was one of the guys on PBS, wrote the book. But his observations were just spot on in the sense that for years, for ages, the old was considered more valuable than the new. The old thing was the thing you revered, not the new thing, because the new thing was untested. It was unproven. Let's take a rocking chair. You've had a rocking chair for 100 years. You got a brand new rocking chair. The question is, which are you going to trust? Well, I'm going to trust the one I've had for 100 years. I know it's well made. I don't know if this one will hold me up. It's the new one. And what he was pointing out is that we are living in a culture where the new thing is always better than the old thing. And we got new TVs that are better than the old TVs. These flat screens as opposed to the old boob tube, you know. We've got new cars that are better than the old, new washing machines better than the old washing machines. We are in a situation that since the 60s, since about that time, we flip-flopped everything. And so there's a adulation of youth, an adulation of the rebel, the outside-the-box person. All those go ahead. We better get off this thing. And anyway, it's fascinating to think about that. That, yeah, for centuries, the old thing was what you valued, not the new thing. The new thing, you didn't know if it was good or not. You couldn't trust it. But we are in a very, very different society than mankind typically has experienced in our history on good old planet Earth. All right? Let's look at the next one. There are three things that are never satisfied. Yay. Four, that say it is enough. Now, this phrase, there are three things, no, four, is found throughout this chapter. And let me ask you, just hearing that, what does that do to you when you hear that phrase? There are three, no, four. That there could be more? Well, when I say, and I had this happen in Mexico, I was preaching, I can't remember which session, on what, and I said, well, there's two things that this verse shows. I never got around to saying the second thing, and later on, half a dozen of these guys came up and said, you never did tell us what the second thing was. That when I list, there's two things I want to tell you here, and I don't tell you that second thing. You have remembered the fact there's supposed to be two things. And first of all, I think this does that. This tells us in advance that there's four things about to come, and so we're looking for those four things, right? This tips you off. The other thing it does is when he says there's three, now there's four, it makes me wonder what that fourth one was. It sort of focuses my attention on the fact I'm about to have a list of things, and I need to pay special attention to what that fourth one was. So it's like a literary device that grabs your attention and sort of sucks you in, and it makes what's following a unit. Remember, the Hebrew has no punctuation whatsoever. There's no periods. There's no commas. It just all run together. And so the point is, well, how do we know what fits in a block? Well, this is one way the ancients could put in a concise little cube their thoughts, because we know we're looking for the next four things that are about to be spoken. So the four things, he says, that are never satisfied: the grave, the barren womb, the earth that is not filled with water, the ground that soaks up the water, and the fire that saith not, it is enough. Okay? Everybody agree with those four? Now notice we're personifying the grave, aren't we? We're speaking of the grave as if it were a person, but that the grave is never full. The grave never says, that's it, that's enough. Whoa, stop. It's always waiting for more. The barren womb is interesting. Would you agree with the statement that the barren womb never says it is enough? And why? Well, is this, the barren womb wouldn't be barren after you've born the child. It seems to me to be the hunger to bear a child. Seems to me that nothing else will quite satisfy like the birth of a child. And so you've got all these women in the Old Testament pining because they can't bear a child. I mean, just think of the list. And what's the big deal? I mean, they're nothing but rug rats, money holes, you know. They're nothing but trouble from day one. Why in the world? Right? And yet, there is a sense in which that is the purpose. I know the secularists will say, well, it's just evolution, survival of the fittest. But why the urge to procreate? It's natural. It's what we're made for. And so a woman who cannot give birth, as we look at a Sarah, then feels incomplete because she's not fulfilling her purpose. And then the water, the ground that is never filled with water. In other words, no matter how much rain, it eventually soaked up. And the fire, this is the one that's really interesting, never says it's enough. The fire will burn as long as you give it something to consume. Now, what in the world is the spiritual principle behind those observations? You always want more. Is it not what Jesus said to the woman at the well? He drinks of this water, will thirst again. There's something about our nature that we're never satisfied with the finite. We'll never get enough. No matter how much we've got, we'll never have enough. Nothing ever scratches that itch. That was Pascal's most interesting observation 500 years ago that basically said there is this void in the heart of every man, and we keep throwing things in it, trying to fill it up, and it's an infinite void. It's the hole that was left in man when man fell in the garden. And that's the other interesting observation. He said if we wouldn't have the consciousness of the hole, if we didn't have a primordial memory of the fact that once there was a time when the hole wasn't there. And Daryl, you're one who lost your sight. But can you imagine someone who never had sight in the first place saying, do you miss not having sight? Well, you never had sight. How do you miss what you never had? And the very fact that you would say, yes, I miss it, means you have the memory of once having it. And what Pascal is pointing out is the very fact that there is this emptiness, this, call it what you will, this hole, this craving for something, this searching for something that will satisfy us in life. What he's saying is that in itself is testimony that there was a time when we didn't have that hole there. That's to me, that's a remarkable observation. Yeah. Because we wouldn't be missing it. We wouldn't know something's wrong otherwise. We just think that's normal. But we don't think it's normal. We're trying to fix it. We're trying to fill that void. All right, let's go to the next one. There are three things which are too wonderful for me, yea, four, which I know not. I like this one. The way of an eagle in the air, the way of a serpent on a rock, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea, and the way of a man with a maid. John, you going to say something? There is I'm skipping over some of these single to give us for the sake of time. I wanted to deal with the number ones. The ESV. It's not the ESV only. There is another one. Yeah, it's that the one about the eye that gets pecked out, the evil eye gets pecked out. Yeah, I was going to skip over that one, yeah, for the sake of the ladies here. But this one of my favorites. The way of an eagle in the air. Why is that an amazing thing? The way of an eagle in the air. What is so remarkable? Yeah, it has something that big. Fly. Yeah, just flight in the first place, and then for an eagle to fly. One of my most vivid memories of Wyoming was a morning out antelope hunting right at the crack of dawn, and we've driven through the sagebrush out to these shelves. They go the strata. They call it the overthrust belt because each strata sticks out and broken off, and you may be 100 feet above the next one. You go up to the edge and look down, and that one goes over, and you look down, and we're hunting antelope. So I got out of the truck, and I'm walking over there, and it's, of course, beautiful, crisp September morning, and the smell of the sagebrush, just wonderful. And I'm looking down, and sure enough, there's some few antelope down below, and all of a sudden, off in the distance, I hear a rumble. And I'm thinking it's thunder, and I'm looking up at the horizon. There's a whole herd of wild horses stampeding across the prairie. And about that time, I'm thinking, there's a tree trunk down there. And about the time it hit me, there's no trees around here. That tree trunk took off. It was a huge golden eagle. Huge. I mean, I had the sense that it was as big or bigger than me. This thing was gigantic. And here that thing takes off and flies right over my head. And just the sheer size of this thing. How does it get in the air? How does it stay in the air? And then secondly, the way of a serpent on a rock. Now, what is that saying? How does it go? It has no legs. How does it go up a slick rock? You see the point? Yeah, this is rather remarkable. And then the third one, the way of a ship in the midst of the sea. Do you realize that a sailboat can actually go faster into the wind than with the wind? In fact, some of the World Cup catamarans can go twice as fast into the wind as they can go with the wind. Does that make sense? Not a bit. And that's what he's saying. This is strange. This is weird. And then the fourth one is, of course, the romantic one, the way of a man with a maid. Go figure. What is it that happens? What Cupid, you know, we have all kinds of explanations for what happens when two people fall in love. Why do fools fall in love? The old song says. But that's what he's basically saying. And he's ranking that right up there with the eagle flying and the ship in the sea and the snake with no legs. Okay, my question is, okay, these are wonderful things, and I really appreciate the observation, but what's the spiritual lesson here, do you think? I think you're probably on the right track. In other words, it's basically in praise of mystery, that there are mysterious things that just don't make a lick of sense, and yet we know they work, which prepares us then for the mystery of the gospel, the greatest mystery of all. In fact, remember, the gospel is called by Paul the mystery of God. And in what sense is it a mystery? Well, it had to be revealed. That's like a mystery. You got to read to the end of the book if you've got a murder mystery, figure out who did it. But it also is, in a sense, an amazing thing, a strange thing, a mystery, and certainly the mystery of the gospel. This is not what we expect. It's not the predictable thing that God would enter this world as a babe in Bethlehem, that God would come to us, Emmanuel, that God would go to a cross and die for his people. Can you imagine? There is a mystery. We stand in awe of these things, and I think this sort of prepares you for that. Okay, let's go to the next one. I think I skipped a verse here too, John. Don't get too excited here. There be four things which are little upon the earth. Notice this guy likes four. That's his favorite number. There are four things which are little upon the earth, but they're exceedingly wise. The ants are a people not strong, and yet they prepare their meat in the summer. The conies, which is like a rock chuck, are but a feeble folk, yet they make their houses in the rock. The locusts have no king, yet go they forth all of them by bands. And the spider, and most of your modern translations say lizard. I think this word only occurred twice in the whole Old Testament. The King James translators didn't have a ghost of an idea what it was. They made a guess. But we know now it means lizard. The lizard taketh hold with her hands and is in king's palaces. Yes? Yes. No. Well, we will. No, I wasn't going to. But, okay, notice these four little things. What do those four little things teach us? Let's skip, yeah, back to that. First of all, what do you learn from the ant? What's that? Yeah. The ant has got two things going for it. His forethought and his industry. And so there's lessons that we can learn from the ant by watching the fact that here's this little critter that apparently doesn't have much brains, couldn't have much, it's too small, but it knows enough to think ahead, to lay up for the winter, and it knows to be industrious in that quest. That diligent work is a good thing. Then the second one, the coney or the rock chuck. What do you learn from the rock chuck? Okay, back to the idea of the wise man built his house on the rock. If you're weak, you better have a strong house. You better have a strong refuge. And that's what the rock chuck has. He may not be a very ferocious thing. We used to have rock chucks out west that lived in the rocks, holes in the rocks. And they were not a vicious animal at all, easy prey. And yet, they had their houses in the rocks. They get in the hole in the rock. You're not going to get them out. So if you're weak, then you need to have a stronghold. You need to have a refuge, a hiding place. Right? Third thing, the locusts, they have no king, but they go forth all of them by bands. The observation is that there's no king over the locusts, but the locusts move as one. They move as though someone is commanding them. What do you think the observation is teaching you? That's what comes to my mind. That there's no seen leader, and yet they to act as one, to move as one. And then the fourth one, the spider or the lizard takes hold with her hands and is in king's palaces. What is that telling you? The idea, I think, is basically saying aim high. That even this lowly creature is found in the highest places by its tenacity. It wants in bad enough. It gets in the high places. And so it's a lesson. Again, a lot of these are basically telling you to learn something from these animals. They have a wisdom that you would do well to emulate in certain aspects. The ant in his foresightedness, the rock chuck in his knowing his own weakness and realizing his need of a stronghold, the locusts and so forth acting as many, moving as one, and then the spider or the lizard finding itself in the highest room, the highest station, that even the White House has to clean the critters out of it. They manage to get in if they're tenacious enough. And so the idea is that they're our expectation, we should aim high, as it were. All right? Next one. There be three things which go well, yea, four are comely in going. The way they move. A lion, which is strongest among beasts, and turneth not away for any. A greyhound, and by the way, I think most of the writers now say the greyhound is a male rooster. A male rooster. Is that what is yours? A strutting rooster. Greyhound, yeah. Well, a greyhound moves well, and that was the King James guy's best guess, but they didn't have a clue. Again, these words are not found anywhere else, so you don't have anywhere else to go on. Strutting rooster, or male rooster, is generally the accepted translation today. And then the he-goat, the male goat, and a king who is in a place of security in his position, surrounded by his armies, as it were. All right. Would you agree with the observation? Does a strutting rooster go well, move well? What is that saying, to move well? It's like to move with no fear, with no trepidation. He's cocksure of himself. Exactly. The lion moves. He has no one, he's the strongest among beasts, so he has no, as far as I know, there are no predators for lions. So in other words, he moves that way. He's not scared of anything. The rooster, the he-goat, I would think this is probably referring to the mountain goat, because of his station up on the sides of the cliff of the mountain, has no fear of anything. And then finally, the king, against whom there is no rising up. Now, what's the lesson? What is necessary to move well? I mean, we're talking about the going of the thing, the stateliness. Am I getting that idea across? In other words, not gracefulness, that's the wrong word, but the stateliness. That I think that is the absolute, the lesson that's getting across here is the benefit of assurance, that when we are sure of our standing, it shows itself in how we move, how we conduct ourselves in the world. I was just thinking about, a couple of things. We were discussing the Muslims at supper tonight and the fact that really in Islam there is no assurance. You just hope you've done well enough. You hope Allah will be merciful, but there is no guarantee. There is no promise. There is no covenant. It's just a hope-so. You don't have a clue how good you've got to be, or whether you've been that good, or what kind of mood Allah may be in the day you face Him. But there is no assurance. Whereas a Christian moves differently in the world. That the sense is we know of ourselves that we're nothing, and yet we are in the rock. We have a firm foundation. And therefore you find men, and Luther is the one that comes to mind, who was absolutely fearless in the face of his opponents. And Luther, he died of natural causes. But he wrote that he never woke up a day that he didn't think he would be dead before evening. In other words, he never lived a day of his life where he felt like he was secure in a physical sense. And yet the guy was absolutely fearless. Take on anybody and everybody. And you ask yourself, what gave him that confidence? What gave him that swagger? And I don't think this is a swagger. You know, we look at the football player doing his strut and stuff after he scored the touchdown. I'm not talking about that kind of swagger, but a swagger in the things of God, a boasting in the cross of Jesus Christ. That we're not glorying in self, but we are glorying in our God, and having that security, that sense of assurance that we are, there is no, therefore now no condemnation to them who are in Christ Jesus. All of a sudden that shows itself in how we do what we do here in this world, in our strut, or being cocksure, as David put it. And that the interesting thing, the liberals look at us and say, you don't need to be so arrogant. You don't need to be so proud. You know what they're saying, what they're talking about? They're saying, well, you fundamentalists, they call us, you say Jesus is the only way, and you're so sure of yourself, and you're so, you know, certain that your view is the right view and so forth. You need to have a little humility. You will see that all through liberal Christianity writings. And the point they're missing is that our sureness is not in ourselves. It's in the Word of our God. It's not in ourselves. It's what our Savior has done for us. And therefore, when we glory, we're not glorying in us. We're glorying in Him. And that shows up in how we live in this world, that we're not in fear. Reese Norris, their adult choir, gave their concert a while back, and one of the songs that just really grabbed me, it's called The Pilgrim's Song. And I can't remember all the words, but the chorus goes, "My soul doth long to go where I will fully know the glory of my Savior. And as I pass along, I'll sing the Christian song. I'm going to live forever." Let that sink in. I'm going to sing the Christian song. I'm going to live forever. You can kill my body, but you can't kill my soul. And so there is a cocksureness that a Christian has, and that is necessary to have. Becky, you're probably the best example of what happens when you don't have that, of the incapacitation that comes into your life, the absolute, just absolute uselessness, because you can't function as a Christian is supposed to function unless you have that sense of your acceptability with your God. Our Christian life flows out of our thankfulness and our gratitude for what God has done for us, and our peace comes from the fact that we have a firm foundation to stand on. And once that, if that's taken away from us, then we're just floundering. All right. There you go. A few lessons from Proverbs 30. Good stuff. I personally love those observations and the way they're stated, just really drills home some needed things. And I just pray the Lord make us smarter than ants, because there's folks out there that are dumber than ants. They really are. Give no thought to eternity, no thought to what's coming next. All right, well, let's go to prayer.